This is the Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and I am here with Sandra Yanone, and we are all remote, but that doesn't take away any of the goodness. Sandra has a debut collection, Boats for Women, and she's going to tell us about it with an opening poem. Sandra, let's hear.
Thank you, Grace. This is the title poem, Boats for Women. Yes, the boat sank. Yes, it broke in two like a stereotypical heart. Before it plummeted to depths no one could measure, until 70 years later, technology caught up and looked its ancestor in the face. Yes is the way the years oxidized the steel, and yes wipes the name Titanic off the bow. Yes are the lifeboats, the davits, the call for women and children first. Yes are the men who cry from the decks. Sometimes when I kiss her, I am leaving a yes on her lips to let her know I will go down with this ship. Sometimes when she whispers, yes, we are staying on board, but there is always room in the lifeboats for two more women. Yes is the fact that if we were alive on that night, we would have lived.
The brilliant voice of Sandra Yanone. How did you know to tie that together with yes? What made you do that? The yes. How did you construct it with that so that that made it, that was the beautiful glue?
You know, I wanted to have something that truly punctuated the beginning of the poem and affirmed everything that would be in that poem. And the word yes is a simple word, but a very complex one.
Affirmation, that is a good answer. A yes on her lips. What a line. That would be a great title for a book. A yes on her lips.
That would be.
This is what we're talking about, this book today, Boats for Women. Sandy, do women need boats to survive? Do women need to navigate? Do women need to stay afloat in relationships with others?
I continue to hear poem after poem after poem from other women. And the poems that I continue to write that affirm, yes, that in fact continues to be deeply true. I think all you have to do is look at the news to see
women,
that.
Women need women.
Yeah, women need women.
This book is a powerful testament, and it's a debut book. So tell us what's in it.
Well, there's four segments. And they basically take us through this matrix of silence, disaster, desire, and hope. And I feel like the intersections of those four are truly the themes of the book as they weave through the poems, including poems about the Titanic disaster, Bess Houdini, and poems, decade poems, and poems about other women.
Mm-hmm. We're going to hear all of that. When you finished this book, what did you know about yourself that you did not know before?
Well, I happened to listen to a very special program that you did with Yvonne Boland, where she talks about the difference between history and the past. And what I truly learned was that there is a convergence, a necessary convergence between those two that makes for very expansive poetry, more expansive than if I had just focused on my own past.
Wow. How does poetry change us then? How does the writing of poetry change us?
I can't imagine a life without poetry. It allows me to connect with people, places, time, space, and truly humanity. Mm-hmm. It gives me a greater capacity for compassion and empathy, and it has taught me how, more importantly than to read, than how to listen.
Mm. Amen, sister. Let us prove it with another poem. Sandra Yanone, her new book is this one, Beautiful Boats for Women. And here's Sandy.
Well, there's a series of poems in the voice of Bess Houdini. And you can imagine my absolute delight when I realized the Titanic and Houdini overlap. They're two of my obsessions. Mm. This poem captures that in a bit of a conceit and a lie. I won't tell you which is which. Bess Houdini reveals her secret to the modern world. His cruelest of all tricks, irreversible, and no one knew. Before, all sleight of hand, knots slipping, lockpicks under tongues. I remember the taste of metal in my mouth as I bent to kiss him before each death-defying act. How once the pick punctured the wall of my cheek and I bled. Sometimes he got a little out of hand, like the night he performed the water can in Philadelphia during the January freeze. The Bergdahl Brewing Company filled his cell with 8 gallons of lager. He escaped, intoxicated, all boast, betting the locals he could make Titanic disappear. From his armchair, 3 months later, in his confident drawl, all saved from Titanic after collision. His portrait smiling, handcuffed in tuxedo and leg irons, propped next to him on the end table. The next day, I slipped out of the house, bought my own morning paper before he woke. The headlines still accused the iceberg, the grainy photograph of the lifeboats empty on White Star's piers 58 and 59. I stood on the street corner. I knew the full capacity of what he could take from this world and what he would not give back.
Whoa, Bess Houdini reveals her secret to the modern world. There's a bunch of poems about Bess Houdini. I'm full of questions about this. First of all, how did you arrive at that persona? And how easy is it to hide behind a persona and be able to say more than we would have before?
Well, the persona has been my very good friend over the years. But honestly, with Bess, I had been reading books about Houdini, and yet she felt behind the curtain, and I wanted to draw her out. I felt she was as remarkable a figure in history as he was, and I felt a little angry that she didn't get her due.
I love that, Sandy, because what happens here is you have created a person that no one knew about, and now they will never go away. Bess Houdini has been made permanent, and we will all know who she is. Just the power of retrieving a person hidden in history and making them available, that is kind of a miraculous thing. So, but why your obsession with Houdini?
I, as a girl, fancied myself as a magician. I did magic tricks shows in my house for my family. And so Houdini had just been this figure that I became interested in. But then from him, I became really interested in what happens when a woman is in the shadow. And how can she emerge? And that's really what those poems are about.
Thank you. Thank you for everyone for that. And I hope you continue retrieving women from history. And this is the book, Sandra is our guest today, and we'd like you to take two poems now and set them each up with a little context so that we know where we're going, and we're just going to sit back and love it.
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, Boats for Women has four sections in it. The maritime disaster poems that are really the personal and the historical, the poems in the voice of Bess Houdini, which we just heard. And the second section is a poem, poems that I write one for every decade of my life. So I'll read that one and then set up the fourth poem for you. This is 2014. All those years behind tinted windows, on the go, a passport tucked in my back pocket, waiting for reprieve, a passionate traveling, always hurt, head against mine, unfinished prisons, flying fire, worthless, worthwhile dreams. I chose the former, that I was not the way I could not stand. The world, now as belly, recovers a woman, a man. I must miracle and finally disrobe.
Oh, keep going.
And the next poem is from the final section called Other Women. And honestly, Grace, I chose this poem for you. It reminded me a little bit of your poem that I adore so much that I read in American Poets, Safety. And this is Counting Backwards. It's dedicated to the actress Jessica Hecht, who you'll learn about in the poem. Counting Backwards. I met your father once in your backyard. The summer, I can't remember. You turned 7 or 8. Your father's hands tied a snug knot to the back of my head to secure a blindfold, then guided me into a gentle spin 3 times round. I know it was him because I heard his count out loud, a voice that made me feel safer in that brief summer eclipse. The stick I maneuvered as best I could to seek out the magnificent pinata, my body and hands dizzy, barely striking air. And in the second before I gave myself over to becoming stupid, I felt your father's steady, steady hands cup over mine. And together we struck something solid, a crack like thunder above me, then the hard candy spilling to the electric green grass like cellophane rain from the split belly of the cray paper donkey. Kids swarmed us like giddy bees, and this is where my memory of your father starts and stops as you stop our brisk walk down Broadway short to share how his current state of tremors has shaken you. Until tonight, I haven't seen you in 40 years. Until tonight, when I'm seated in the audience, just shy of starstruck, across from you on stage at the Manhattan Theater Club. 40 years ago, I stood next to you on the worn wooden stage at the far end of the Metacomet Grade School's gymnasium, where we performed our first plays and practiced belting out I Am Woman for the third grade talent pageant, as if certain we knew what womanhood meant. I don't tell you that my sister has cancer, that she's indecisive about treatment. I don't tell you so many things, monumental and inconsequential, that I don't have to tell you in habits 40 years, although I want to, like this memory of your father's hands, or every time we barely knew we'd share at 6 or 7.
Well, that is a poem that no beginner could write. The long poem, which crosses back and forth across time, that has characters, situations, that brings a past and a present together. How long did it take to write?
I started it the night that I went to her play and continued it. It took me probably about 5 years.
I don't doubt it. I bet you came back and back to that thing. There's not a lump in it. It's just pure silk. And it just shows so much craft. What do you think is the strongest thing about this poem?
In this poem, that part about Helen Reddy's song, I Am Woman, where it talks about that as if certain we knew what womanhood meant.
In the third grade.
And I really come back to that because I feel like this book and my whole life has been and will continue to be an exploration of what womanhood means and has meant, right? Both the past, the present, and the future.
And we will know more about it because of you. One of the things I like the most is your treatment of the father and how you learned trust for the first time. And that's a really positive note in your poetry. There is nothing in your poetry that negates anyone else, which I think is very interesting. And it doesn't come from a person who is just a beginner spiritually, really. So if someone else wrote this poem, what would you say to that person?
What an amazing, amazing question.
Just to objectify, because you're a teacher and someone brings this, what do you see in this writer?
I see a person with empathy for the temporal.
That's a good one. That's a good one. And the temporal, you change quite a bit. It changes throughout the poem.
Yes.
Which is interesting. Do you think this is your Ars Poetica?
You know, it certainly could be. It's funny. It's not a poem that I read that often, ironically. And yet I do love it. But it's oddly one of the most intimate poems to me. I'm not afraid of intimacy. I'm not afraid of sharing things. But it's been one that I've kept close to my heart because I feel like I wrote it to her, old childhood friend, and even though it's in the book.
On a practical level, to give a public reading for such a long, intricate poem, by the time they get to the end, they might have forgotten the beginning. So I can see how in a closed space like this, radio is so good for long poems. But to perform in public, I can see why this isn't your first choice. Now, let us switch gears and have a station break and talk about the work you are doing in the world. Wow, many people are presenting poets, and more than ever. I mean, when I started in Washington in 1968, we did the first poetry reading or something. Now, of course, it's proliferating everywhere, and now through Zoom. But I don't think anyone is producing and presenting more poets per week than you are in Cultivating Voices. How did you begin that? Why did you begin it? And what's going on with it?
Well, Cultivating Voices live poetry emerged after I attended the AWP in San Antonio in March of 2020. My sister called me on the phone. Things were going into lockdown from the pandemic. And she said, I have an idea. I'm really concerned that all the readings that you had set up to promote Boats for Women will disappear. And I've been listening to a live open mic for musicians in the Philadelphia area because they've lost all their in-person venues. How about we try to do what they do on Facebook and for poetry? She's not a poet. She doesn't even like poetry, honestly. She'd tell you that to your face. And I said, no, I don't want to do this. I do not like technology. But she cajoled me, and we began a journey every single week, every single Sunday during the pandemic. We've held a space for poets to come together in very different formats. The first format was a live open mic. 12 poets would come on for 15 minutes each from all over the world. And now we also feature new book showcases, because we definitely want to amplify the difficulty of poets launching their books during the pandemic. And we've had some great special events, like a Poetry Pride parade in June, Juneteenth reading, and Votes for Women for the 100th anniversary of women's suffrage. It's been a miraculous journey.
How many poets do you think you've presented?
Hundreds, easily.
Hundreds. And this is every week, right?
It is every Sunday. And sometimes an occasional Monday. We've done 2 Labor Day readings with Lost Horse Press's anthology, Raising Lily Ledbetter, Women Occupy the Workspace, on Labor Day the past 2 years. So occasionally we slip in an additional reading. We've done a few tribute readings to Evanne Boland, who's one of my favorites.
Yes. Yes, she's your influencer.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I saw you run in last Sunday. Was it Sunday? Yeah. And you had just been teaching or something. And you ran on microphone. You had just come from one gig to another gig. And how much time does it take during the week to work that up each week? What percentage of your time do you think you give to that?
Well, I have a few staff. I'll call them staff people. They are collaborators. They are gifts. Don Krieger and Kim Ports Parsons, extraordinary poets in their own right, who help with the background. I probably devote about 5 to 10 hours a week between posting things to the Facebook group, prepping behind the scenes bios, getting ready for the poets to come on, and helping publicize.
And you also give a lot of tender, loving care to each poet personally through emails to prep them so that they come into a very comfortable space. What I thought was so cool is your technical person is from Olney, Maryland, like right next door to me. Yes. And here you are in the Pacific Northwest. Yes. What city are you in?
I am in Olympia, Washington.
And give us the title of your series again and how people can access it.
It's Cultivating Voices, Live Poetry. There's a Facebook group of that name that anyone is welcome to join. And from that, we post every week event pages for the individual readings. They're also recorded, so you can watch them after the fact if you're not able to join us live in Zoom or watch live on Facebook. I love the live in Cultivating Voices Live.
Yeah.
But we know that not everyone can come every week to be with us.
Her name is Sandra. Her name is Sandy Yanon. Her book is her first book. But wait a minute, there's one coming up. And that is forthcoming. What do you think is different from your new book?
It's completely different because it's a meditation on one thing. Every single poem has the word glass in it.
Whoa. Was that hard to do?
Not really. My parents are stained glass artists. And so it beat the title poem. Talks with my early experiences with glass. And I started to notice that glass was really inhabiting a lot of my poems and thought, how about something that shows that prismatic aspect of one word?
It's very symbolic. Yes. And in addition to that, we will tell everyone that her poems have been in the best of online journals, Plowshares, Poetry Ireland Review, in print journals, Prairie Schooner, Women's Review of Books, Lambda Literary Review. You've been nominated for the Best of the Net and Pushcart prizes. And of course, Cultivating Voices Live is getting you to be a household name, in my household anyway. So let's go ahead and tell us about The Girl Who Catches Everything.
When I was in college, I took a class with my professor, Sue Standing, and she said, we're going to write all in forms. And I almost pulled my hair out. I was so angry. And now I adore what forms can do. So this is a poem about, again, we go back to girlhood, but it takes us to womanhood and that slippery slope. And this is the closing poem to the collection, actually, called The Girl Who Catches Everything. We have all the time in the world, in pants pockets, in the space between our breasts, on our tongues, and in the future, twirling over us like a girl's fire baton hurled into the stadium sky. In her hands, she will catch all she has all the time. The world will not throw her off balance, despite the swirl of the crowd anticipating her drop, the stress on the edge of every tongue. In the future, twirling naked in bed, we will remember these baton girls. We did not risk the chance to undress when we had all the time in the world. We will remember their hair, every curl we did not allow our fingers to address, or our tongues, or the future twirling away from their spectacular bodies. We will pearl our lives with each minute lost. The rest we will have all the time in the world and on our tongues where the future twirls.
Her work has received the Academy of American Poets Prize and an AWP award. She earned her BA in writing and literature from Wheaton College. That's an MA, then an MFA from Emerson College, then a PhD in English from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, where you might have met Ted Kooser. Currently, she is the faculty director. Are you still the faculty director of the Writing Center at Evergreen State College?
I am. I'm going right back to work after we're done.
I mean, I can't even get all these degrees. You've been studying poetry for years. You've been studying poetry for years. You've been immersed in poetry in years. You have more degrees than a thermometer. You are just, you are immersed in the art of teaching, presenting, and writing poetry. Did you know at 5 years old you'd be doing this?
No. One thing you don't know from my bio is I went to law school.
Show off. Show. Can you show off anymore?
Yes, I can. Here, no, I'm not going to show off. I'm going to show you humanness. I quit. I left law school.
How does law school help? But doesn't law school help a little bit with poetry?
Oh, it sure does.
How?
First of all, the stories of the cases are intoxicating. And also, it's about the details. It's always about the details.
Very interesting. And poetry is always about the details, right?
Indeed.
And how did you go through the first year of law school?
I went a year and a half. I got halfway through.
You have paid more tuition and more colleges than anyone I know. And what do you think? What do you think after getting an MA, an MFA, a PhD, has that helped your writing, or what has that done?
It provided me very humbly with the most amazing mentors I could ever have had connection with.
Good answer. Good answer. Throwing the baton. That is such a good answer. We would like another one. Let's try something from your new book.
Okay. I'm going to share with you the title poem, if you'll indulge me. It's The Glass Studio. I must go back to that photograph of me, 14, on an early morning in my father's makeshift sweatshop on the unfinished second floor of my grandparents' house, leaning over beige glass squares arranged in a plaster-poured mold, my Red Sox cap cocked backwards like a trigger waiting for release, my left hand steadying the steaming soldering iron, while my right pushes coiled snakes of lead into the iron's hot tip to melt them into quicksilver seams, fusing those cut glass squares into translucently beautiful panes if I hold them up to the light breaking through the second floor window. I sweat through this labor. I breathe in the noxious fumes. I wear no protective mask. My hot pink lungs slow burn towards death. Hour after hour, I run my hands over glass like this, iron and lead, like over the seams of women's bodies. It will take years for me to touch. I use the same precision to bring them full circle to when they become translucent. My father teaches me all this with squares of cut glass, not ever saying the word sex, without ever claiming to transfer the knowledge of how he broke into my mother's body to create something sacred akin to a family. Downstairs, my grandfather returns from hours emptying glasses filled with Kentucky bourbon and ice, brings home his daily ragings like newspaper headlines, and smashes everything on the first floor to tiny bits. I sit up here on a metal stool in the glass studio, mute like a bird who has lost faith in song, soldering everything back into place. At the height of these humid summer afternoons, my father disappears after his initial instructions and before my grandfather returns. He teaches me not to press the iron against any glass square in the mold for too long. He shows me how the iron-willed iron desires nothing beautiful in its intention to burn. So if left resting on the glass's skin, it will provoke an irrevocable wound. After hours inside of the sweat and burn, heat from the tip of the iron threatening to welt my skin with each beaded line, the fumes filling my lungs like my grandfather's cigarette smoke overtakes the living room where my grandparents sit, ruined downstairs. I close up the studio, pressing the sashes down hard and drawing the curtains closed like stitches, turn off my iron, clean the tip in toxic flux until it smokes, whip down the staircase where on the other side of the wall, my grandparents smolder in today's aftermath of broken glass. I pull the door tight to keep them inside, turn the brass doorknob hot in my palm, run next door, up the stairs to my bedroom, and strip. My skin, now a mix of sweat and lead and labor and fear. I pull on my one-piece bathing suit, ride my bike fast away to the beach, lay down on the hot sand next to the beautiful girls on their backs, on their striped towels, tanning themselves into womanhood, their new breasts coming in like delicate blown glass floats adrift from the sea and landing on the creamy skin of the shore, miraculously whole, like art, like the glass-infused light cast from the hanging lamps I assemble through my teenage years in the illegal glass studio of my family's naive making.
Sandra Yanone, there is not a better poem written than that one. There's not a better poem. You
to Grace.
Put everything in that. You did not hold back anything. You used language, imagery, story. You opened your heart. That is, my body does not lie. That is a poem I'll never forget. And I look forward to reading it in your new book. And what a reading. What a reading you gave. Your soul is right out there for us to touch. Thank you for that. Thank you for that. Before we go to a final poem, I'm interested in your Irish connection. Your books are published by Salmon Press. I guess that's in Ireland. You have a strong connection to Ireland. Are you Irish?
I'm not, although the Irish poets, many friends that I've made of some of the Irish poets are like, you're honorary. I think it comes from the Titanic. My deep connection comes from the fact that the ship was built in Belfast. One of my favorite places in the world is a square in Cove, Ireland, which was Titanic's last port of call, as well as a place where there is an unbelievable statue to commemorate and honor those who lost their lives in the Lusitania disaster, which also happened right off the coast of Cove. So that's been my connection.
Wow.
That's what brought me to Ireland, is Titanic. And then that brought me to all the poets that I've met, and I'm so grateful.
Well, that is a porthole for us to look into your work more, about you bringing forth a Titanic, which some days is forgotten, but not by you. And now Sandra Yannone will give us a final poem.
Grace, I want to dedicate this poem to you.
I'll take it.
This is called Manifesta. These are declarations of the most intimate kind, the ones you kiss into your pillow through the concentric night until you wake to feel the presence of the beloved arriving from the other room, even though she is 3 states or 11 miles away. In this moment of half-lucid dream, the distance stands before you, irrelevant as desired new boots. Alone in bed, which side to exit to the floor of today matters less. You've made the choice to turn toward a sacred face, a turn toward your own longing to live. To meet the day head on, not so much a collision as a delicate fusion of strangers now becoming known. In this compressed space, the new feels misplaced, like keys lost for weeks. Beloveds, beloveds. Punch your time cards, your optimism tickets, with restless tears to clock the moment you tattoo your present name to your forehead. A reminder that you'll look in the mirror with wonder each morning. See yourself. And remember that the beholder is the eye of Grace.
Sandy Yannone, what a voice. We will follow you like a meteor through your life. Come see us in person as soon as you can. The inimitable Sandy Yannone. This program is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. The program is produced by Forest Woods Media Productions. Post-production by Mike Turpin, MET Studios. We wish to thank the Library of Congress for making the program possible. Funding is provided by the Rivada Foundation of the Logan Family and the Sinipet Fund. Our engineer is Mike Turpin. I'm Grace Cavalieri.